Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Colin Jeffress. How are you, Colin?
I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. We're going to be talking about, it's hard to describe, infrared spectrometry sort of thing. I don't know exactly what it is, but in a nutshell, what are you peddling?
Okay, we've got a device that we call the BevScan, and its official title is a near-infrared beverage analyzer. But in reality, what it does, it actually looks through an unopened bottle of wine and fingerprints that wine in such a way that we can make a comparison later on with other bottles of wine to tell whether they're the same, whether they're a counterfeit, whether they've varied in production, or whether they've varied because of oxidation or some other problem.
Okay, so that sounds pretty cool. Sounds like when you say near infrared.
No, it's not cool. It's actually a little bit warm, actually.
What is near infrared though? Is that, you know, I don't quite know what that is.
Okay, in the spectrum, the electromagnetic spectrum, we see a certain portion, a wavelengths, which we call the visible, and just above the visible wavelengths, and in fact we use some of the visible wavelengths, but just above the visible wavelength is the short wave near infrared, and then a bit beyond that, a little further, is the near infrared range. It's something that we cannot see with the eye, but we have sensors which are very sensitive to those wavelengths, and that can tell us a great deal about the physical properties of a lot of materials.
Something like a remote control uses infrared, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And that's done purely and simply so that you can't see it. It's not going to flash you in the eye. And it can, on a near-infrared wave like that, you can encode a lot of information to tell it that you want to change channel or change volume and
just
so on.
Just like turning it off and on.
Correct.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And how does that relate to something like ultraviolet?
Ultraviolet is at the other end of the spectrum.
The blue end.
The blue end, you push it off the far end, then you go ultraviolet, and you've got to be very careful because ultraviolet can do some terrible things to human beings. Usually not so much in the NIR region is there a problem, but certainly UV is something we have to be very careful of.
Okay, so if you think it goes, what, UV, and then Roy G. Biv, no, blue, indigo, violet,
yeah,
all the way up.
Right, that's your red,
and then you get up to red, and then you're near infrared. Okay.
And then infrared after that.
Okay. All right, no, that's cool. And the infrared, that's what they use for looking at heat signatures, isn't it, with those goggles?
Night vision goggles, yes.
Okay, cool. You're trying to fingerprint wine bottles, is that right?
Yeah, one of the issues that people have is how do you define a bottle of wine once it's sealed and in the bottle? Maybe it's been there for 20 years or 30 years. How do you know anything about it without destroying it? So, yeah, sure, you can pull the cork and taste it and say, oh, that was awful, or that was absolutely fantastic.
Yep.
But really, you want to know what's in the bottle without opening the thing. And effectively what we've done is develop a system in conjunction with the Australian Wine Research Institute, which allows us to just pass a very harmless, what looks to be just a pencil beam of light through the bottle. In reality, it's also got a lot of near-infrared in it. And by passing it through the bottle, we first of all make a reference of the beam without the bottle in place. So we sort of measure that beam and we know what its content is. We then put the bottle in place in that beam, and through the sensor, look at what lands up at the sensor once the light has been through the bottle. And by effectively making the difference between the two, we can say the product inside this bottle can be characterized by this information that we've gained extracted out of that light beam. So in a terrible sense, as I said to you before we began, one lady when I said today we have reduced the aura of a bottle of wine to a mathematical equation, she was quite horrified, but in effect we have to do that because then that allows us to do some very sophisticated mathematics on that spectral information, which allows us to make these distinctions between bottles of wine and so on.
And when the light's passing through, does it scatter, or is it the scattering of the light you're after, or how the colors shift or change?
It's really the absorbance. We talk in terms of absorbance.
Okay.
So it's the absorbance of the material as the light beam goes through. Things are taken out of that wave form because they're blocked by Well, the molecular structure of the wine as it goes through. So it's a change. It's a very complex system at the molecular level. And so really we are fingerprinting at the molecular level. But in the end, what lands up at the other side on the sensor is a characteristic footprint, fingerprint, whatever you like to want to call it, for what has been put in the path of that light beam.
Okay. I suppose this is a bit geeky, but when electrons change orbits, they emit photons or they absorb photons. Is that what you're effectively doing?
Yes. There's all sorts of OH bonds and all sorts of things that interfere or are changed by the emission of near-infrared through products.
Okay.
And really, that's a whole other subject.
Yeah, but I don't want to get into that. I think that's enough. So the light comes through. You grab the light. You analyze it. And that gives you an idea. Does it tell you what's in the wine? Like, does it tell you the alcohol levels and the sugar levels?
No. We can do that through other methods. But fundamentally, what we are doing in the BEV scan is saying, we want to know what is the fingerprint of this wine to tell you when we get another wine, is it the same or is it different? In very fundamental terms, that's the way it is. You can use the near-infrared spectroscopy that we use inside our device, and some of the options on the device itself allows you to use it in a standard spectroscopic mode. So you can just scan a product in a cuvette. You can build a model and do predictions against alcohol content and all those sort of things. But that's not the claim to fame, really, of where we are with the BEV scan.
But you can do that.
You can do all that, yes. Yeah. It's a standard laboratory spectrometer for that sort of purpose. And it's when we bring into play the mathematics of what we've done with our SimCal system, as we call it, a similarity calibration. It allows us to define whether two bottles of wine are very, very much the same, in other words, identical, or if there is some difference in that wine because it's had oxidation or there's some other issue with it, or whether it's a totally different vintage or whatever.
Could you tell if the wine's got cork taint in it, for example?
We wish we could be definitive on that, but as with so much in the wine industry, it's subjective, so that you can have two people trying to analyze a wine and saying, "Yeah, you know, I call this a pepperminty raspberry," and somebody else will describe it in a totally different way because the palate is involved. Cork taint is exactly the same. To come to a point and to be able to open enough bottles to really be able to get a scientific basis for cork taint is very difficult. So as far as the BEV scan is concerned, with things like cork taint, if we can get enough samples of genuine cork taint, then we can start building a calibration base to see whether or not it's possible for us to detect it. But to actually open enough bottles and test enough bottles to actually get a truly demonstrable cork taint number of samples is a very difficult thing indeed.
So you can't just say, all right, I've analyzed this wine, I've worked out this wine is, if I get a fingerprint of this, then it's corked. But when you go to a different wine, you may get a different fingerprint. Is that right?
So totally different.
Yeah, so you can't superimpose a fingerprint of cork taint onto another wine?
Nope, not possible. Because we are looking at the signature, first of all, of a wine, and it's the variation of that signature or fingerprint of the wine which says, oh, this is different. If we manage to do a cork taint calibration for one particular wine, it's based on the fingerprint of that wine and the variation from the fingerprint of that wine.
Yep.
So we can't transfer that to another wine. It would be, you would have to do it for every particular wine. But I think it's a valid question, and we've been asked here several times exactly that point, because it is apparently for the European industry a very, very difficult issue. In Australia, as you're probably aware, we've shifted almost totally to screw caps with Stelvin inserts and so on.
So you've got the reduction problem.
Yeah.
Can you measure that?
The people in Australia would say that there isn't any reduction problem.
No, we just like wines that taste a matchstick. No, it's very cool.
Yeah.
What about, you said oxidation though, and oxidation has a definitive colour change when a wine gets too oxidised.
Yeah, well, it doesn't even need to be at that point, of course. Oxidation that can be tasted can be defined long before there's any change in the visible properties of the wine.
Can you measure that though?
Oh, yes, most certainly. So oxidation is a very simple one to measure.
Cork taint and reduction is almost like extra molecules in there, whereas oxidation is a change of a molecule that's already in there. Is that the
change? Yes, it's the change of the system which is easier to detect for us.
Okay. So you gave me some examples where you we were doing a Jacobs Creek Riesling, was it?
Yeah, correct.
2008.
Yep.
And you sort of showed, yep, it all works. And then you put another bottle in and, yep, you said this is the same wine. And yes. Then you took a 2009 and it was wildly different.
Yes.
Looked the same.
Yes.
Probably tasted very similar, knowing Jacob's yes. Creek year after year, the same wine.
Same blended wine, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But obviously it was a different wine.
Yes.
So is that what you're really trying to do?
That is probably a very poor representation of the sophistication of the device. But basically what we're attempting to do there is make it very clear to people you can have a wine sealed in a bottle that you know nothing about, but it looks, these two look exactly the same. You've got no reason to believe that they are different, but it's quite possible that we can just put it through our system and say, I'm sorry, those two are just not the same wine. If you think it's a 2008 Jacobs Creek Riesling, it's not.
Yeah. Okay.
Or if it is, it's a very badly damaged one that you don't want to know about anyway.
What are the applications for this? Who would want to use the system?
Okay. It, obviously, in counterfeiting fraudulent wines, it's got a big future there because it allows us to build up a SIMCAL, which is portable. When it's finally finished, it's just a little file that fits on a computer, can be put onto a memory stick and transported and so on. But that is then a characteristic for that particular year, for that particular wine. So if it's a 1971 Grange Hermitage or whatever it might be, we can then put that back into the machine at any time. We can take an unknown bottle 6 months later, bung it into the machine and say, is this a 1971 Grange Hermitage? Bing, yes it is, or no, it's not. So it's a very simple device. Now, when it comes to, for instance, premium wine release, you may have a large number of, I don't know, 50 cases, 100 cases of wine, 12, 15 years old. You're going to release it at a premium price, £50, £100 a bottle. You know that because of the cork in the bottle, you can guarantee you will have between 5 and 7% fallout of corkage problems. So it could be cork taint, could be disintegration of the cork, whatever. There will be some influence
yeah.
on the bottle out of the cork that you don't want. Now, the problem is if you're going to sell these at £50 or £100 a bottle, you really don't want even 5 or 7% of your customers coming back and saying, that was absolutely lousy wine and I paid £50 for it. With our system, we can actually test against the master set within probably about 5 seconds. That's including loading and unloading time. So it means that for a very small cost per bottle, you can do a 100% check that there is no major damage to that wine. Now, the one thing I've said that we cannot detect or don't know whether we can detect is cork taint. So that's one that will always sit in the outers. But basically, if you're looking at good wines as the basis for your initial calibration, putting into the system to produce the fingerprint, you can pretty much guarantee that every bottle that you scan through after that is going to be a good bottle of wine.
And how long are the results good for? Because wine, once it gets into a bottle, is a wine 10 years later is not the same wine that went in.
Totally correct.
How good are the numbers? How long do they last for?
The numbers are as good as the wine. In other words, if we've produced a fingerprint for a wine, and for instance, to give you some example, if we use fairly pedestrian white wine like a Jacobs Creek Riesling, probably 6 or 12 months later, you will not be able to use that calibration for that wine because if it's only a year or two old, its maturation curve is very steep and it's changing very quickly. But that's not where you would use this device. We use that for demonstration purposes only. What we're really talking about is if you're talking about premium wines that are probably, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years old, and in that case, their maturation curve has really change very little. So it may mean, and we spoke with some people this morning about this, it may mean that every, 2 or 3 years, you have to do one of two things. Either scrap the calibrations you've got and remake them from your master set of bottles again, or alternatively, it's quite possible to just add in some of the new changed bottles to actually make that calibration now cover not only the original wines, but now the wines that have slightly changed. And we have the capability in the system to actually change the degree of tolerance that we have in the system. In other words, what we say we allow and what we say we won't allow. So that's actually part of the way you set up the device. And you can say, look, I want to be it to be a bit broader. I think that I've got some variation in this wine that I'm quite happy to accept. You can broaden those tolerances and accept those. But again, it will still say, if something is seriously different from your model, that it will pull it out to one side. And
one of the problems with corks is that there is a natural variation associated with corks. As wines age over time, you know, you open 10 bottles up, three are great, three are bloody awful, and four are in the middle. Would you find that you'll get a... Will you have such big tolerances to include that, or are we looking at the wine problem slightly the wrong way?
No, it all depends on the way you want to set up the system. If you reduce the tolerance and if with the assistance of the device as you're setting up those initial SimCals, if you say, I want to be able to pick out these particularly good ones, but these other ones that I put into the system I know are bad, what our system allows you to do is do some simple manipulation that sort of says, these are the good ones, these are the bad ones, please, by running through a few steps, you can say, well, I think I can probably shift those bad ones so that they're unacceptable, but that all the good ones are an acceptable cluster. So it requires a little bit of skill and time in with the device, but effectively it does allow you to say, either we'll include all these and say they're okay, or we can then define that and say, well, no, actually, these are different.
And obviously, storage temperature, if I've got a wine that's 30 years old, you know, I presume, you know, let's say you're in some high-end Bordeaux chateau, they've got their library of wines that have been kept in ideal storage conditions for 30 years, and then all of a sudden Sotheby's say, you know, I've got a wine I need to get confirmed that this is a genuine bottle. You do your analysis, you get your SimCals from the stock from the chateau because you know that's not fraudulent.
Yep.
How close will that wine be, even if it's aged in slightly different conditions?
Quite frankly, if it has been grossly...
poorly aged.
Yeah, thank you. Poorly aged.
Abused.
Abused. We can detect that very quickly. And that will always show itself as being a deteriorated wine.
Can you tell the difference between a fraudulent wine and a deteriorated wine? Because a deteriorated wine would probably be close, but no cigar, whereas a fraudulent wine could be miles out.
Again, it depends on how you want to set your tolerances in the system. If you want to say that I want to be able to detect something that looks similar to this wine, but you know it's got a fair degree of ability to be varied and yet I would still accept it, then that's just a matter of setting up the system that way. You wouldn't normally want to do that. You would normally want to say, look, I want to clearly outline what is a good wine, what is a poor wine. In terms of heat damage, that's one that has come up quite often, and one that we spoke to some people today at the other end of the spectrum from Norway who have a problem with wine that is frozen in the containers as it's shipped around, and they have an enormous insurance problem, because normally what happens now is that whole container will be just scrapped because nobody can make clear distinction in the wine. Whereas what we can do is we can go and say, okay, we know that perhaps the wine in the very middle is going to be acceptable. You open a couple of bottles, yeah, that's fine, okay. So we use some bottles from that central area. We set up a SimCal against that, and we then go and have a look at the very worst wine on the outside that's frozen, put that into the system and say, whoa, wow, there's a... Yeah, we can...
So freezing a wine makes a massive difference.
Yeah. And then you just determine the point at which you will accept or not accept the wine as being drinkable. And that may be that you then go and open a few cartons a couple of points in from the outside of the container and put them through the Bev scan and say, oh, these here, but we can see it drifting and getting worse and worse as we go out. Maybe we try one or two bottles at this point, and that then becomes the point you say, well, if it's between the reference point in the middle and this reference point of these bottles at this point, we'll accept it. Anything outside of that, we throw away.
Okay.
So it means that you could recover, ostensibly, perhaps half of the container load of wine without doing a great deal of work. You know, you don't have to go in and open every box and try it. You can just pretty much say that if you do then a random check of what you are saying is okay, you pull those out of the container, stack them to one side, take a few random cartons or whatever, take a few random bottles out, stick them through the system. If they all sort of comply and they say yes, then you say you pretty much accept that they are all good bottles.
One of the things you showed me was different bottles with different colored glass in it, you know, a blue glass and a green glass, and it still said it was the same wine. How do you do that? Do you just clock that the glass is different and then make allowances for it?
Yeah, again...
Or is there no allowance in the colour of the glass?
No. The system itself doesn't know anything about what you're doing with it. All it knows is the spectra of what it sees. Yeah. But what we have within the device itself is the ability for you to very quickly run through a number of known what we call processes. In other words, we've done a lot of the hard work in our development process to know the things that are the areas and bandwidths and so on that are likely to give you the best results out of the system. And because it's dynamic, you can see the samples that you've put in appear on the screen. You can apply these different processes and you can see whether or not the bad ones have been singled out or whether they've remained clustered with all the good ones. And so you just try a few of the examples that we give you and effectively separate them out that way. And in this case, all we did when there was a glass change, it's fairly obvious that that glass change is going to come at particular points in the spectra. And so we just trimmed our spectra at the point where we know the glass will have the biggest influence and threw that part away.
Yep.
And we can still then get the information that we need out of the rest of the spectra.
And I presume it works just as well for white and red wines?
Yes, white and red. One of the challenges, obviously, in developing the device, and a very big challenge, I might say, was that you're going almost from the point of a clear bottle with water in it through to a deep brown bottle with a deep red wine in it.
Yep.
And so the amount of light that we have to have available to get through a big bottle of heavy red is so enormously different to what we need to put through for almost clear wine in a clear bottle. And part of the secret of what we've done is to allow us to change the light level that runs through the system. And it was a critical part of the design.
You're obviously at the London International Wine Fair today trying to tout this product. Is it ready for commercialization or has it already been commercialized and it's being used? Where in the development cycle are you at?
At the very early stages of the development cycle, it is commercialized in the sense that we have a commercial device that is now available. We can deliver that commercial device. And part of the reason for being here the International Wine Fair was to work in conjunction with our potential partners here in Europe. We've never distributed sugar. Sugar cane is not a thing that grows in Europe, so we've never had any distribution network in Europe. So it's been one to set up a distribution network through Analytic, a company here in Cambridge, and they will be our distributors for the UK and for Europe. And then to literally test the market here in Europe along with them to see what are the particular issues in the UK European marketplace, which will give us a place with the BevScan. It's a sort of a fact-finding mission, and at the same time, it's some market research so that we can move forward from this point.
And we spoke earlier that you guys, as you said just before, you came from the sugarcane industry. Hmm. Can you use this type of technology to determine the quality of the grapes coming in from harvest, for example? Because one of the big things with producers is, you know, particularly if they're buying contract grapes, am I getting good sugar levels? Am I getting good polyphenols in the wine? All that sort of stuff. Can you use it to measure those sort of things?
We have a development program running at the moment for another device that we call the InfraProbe. And that comes from work that we did in the sugar industry, where we used near-infrared to examine samples of sugarcane that are taken from the truck as the truck delivers the sugarcane to the crushing mill. And the grower is paid on the quality of his cane, in other words, how much sugar is in there, how little dirt is in there, and all those sorts of things. We take a plug out of his truck, we put it into our machine, we turn it into what's basically grass clippings, and then using a very sophisticated near-infrared system, we can actually tell them within about 30 to 60 seconds how much sugar is in there, how much dirt is in there, all the parameters of the cane, and the grower is then paid on the basis of that cane. In terms of the grapes, we're endeavouring to do the same sort of thing now, and we have a system, as I said, called the InfraProbe, and basically that's a near-infrared probe. It's about 5-6 inches in diameter, big stainless steel tube with a very heavy sapphire face on the front of it with an angled face, and that actually goes down into a truckload of grapes and literally looks directly in the truck at the grapes and can give you a near-infrared analysis of the grapes. So it can tell you the Bourmet and the color, anthocyanins and things like that in the grape, and do it immediately, not 8 hours later as the current system does. But there are many challenges in that, and I believe it's probably going to take us several more years to really refine that. So it's a long process. But, yeah, there are lots of areas, the whole grape and wine industry, where near-infrared is just such a perfect technology. It's clean. It doesn't destroy anything. It doesn't damage grapes, or damage wine. It really is a clean green technology, frankly.
Excellent, Colin. I think we'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much indeed, Chris.
Yes, bud.